Wake up with the news and information you can trust. Starting your day the right way with the Andy Griffin Show. This is News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU.
Good morning to you, 908 on KDXU. I'm Andy Griffin. Thank you for tuning in today. So good to be back. I had a couple days of vacation, but I'm back in the chair. Glad to be here on a sunshiny day here in southern Utah. I have a friend on the line with me. Dean Clancy is on the line. He's in Florida. You're in Florida, right, Dean?
Yes, that's right.
How is Florida right now? You guys getting rain? Because I heard Florida's like the rainiest state in the country except Hawaii.
Well, it might be, but today it's sunny and beautiful.
Sunny in the Sunshine State. I love that. Dean Clancy is a senior policy fellow at Americans for Prosperity and a Paragon Health Institute public advisor and a self-described old movie buff. You like the old movies, right, Dean?
Oh, yeah. The good ones. Unfortunately,
the good ones.
You have to watch a lot of bad ones to find them.
You got to sort through the bad ones to get to the good ones. We're going to talk about health policy and health insurance and some other things, American Renewal with Dean. But I did want to start with movies just for fun. And I noticed, Dean, you don't have a couple of my favorites on your list, at least not very high on your list. And so I wanted to get your take on my three favorite movies. Now, Princess Bride did make your list, one of the movies you like. But The Green Mile and The Shawshank Redemption are two of my favorites, and neither one of those did very favorably on your list.
Yeah, it's all taste. I guess Princess Bride is absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
I think those other two, those are more of your prison, things. Shawshank does have a very sort of hopeful feel to it. Maybe I underrated that one. I'll grant you that.
I know this. You list it on your website, and I know this about you. You're an optimistic guy, and I like that. I'm an optimistic guy, too. I always try to look for the bright side of things and bring out the positive. That's the way we should live life, in my opinion. But, now, Dean, the old classic question. You're stranded on a desert island. You could only take, say, five movies with you. What would be the five movies that you would have if you knew you were going to be stranded on a desert island for a long period of time?
Oh, wow. I don't have my list in front of me, but, I guess it would be films like Casablanca, the original Star Wars, the one where Han shot first.
Wait a minute. He said, who cares, didn't he? In subsequent interviews, he did shoot first.
Yeah. Huh? Well, the actor doesn't matter. It's the movie, darn it.
Yeah.
Let's see, what else? The...
I know you like '60s movies. Hard Day's Night, Man for All Seasons from the '60s. Doctor Strangelove, some of those classics.
Yeah, Doctor Strangelove. I watch that probably once a year. And The Manchurian Candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just so many, many good ones. How about you?
I gave you my three favorites. Shawshank, Green Mile, and Princess Bride are my three favorite movies. I liked the movie. It was popular, but it didn't really stand the test of time very well, I don't think. But I liked the movie called Lady Hawk and a movie called The Dragon Slayer, a couple of old 70s or late 70s movies that I was a kid in the late 70s. So for me, those two movies captured my imagination. I loved those two shows.
I haven't seen Dragon Slayer. I have to look at that one.
Yeah, it's basically like this apprentice magician tells this village that he can get rid of the dragon. And all he does is make the dragon mad, and then the dragon goes and shoots fire at everybody and stuff. And yeah.
You know, The Thing from 1982 is also one I'll watch. And, of course, Apocalypse Now. Those are a full evening.
Now, I got to ask you, Dean, I noticed on your list there are no movies from I think it's 2004, maybe 2008. So basically your list is, there haven't really been any good movies the last 15 or 20 years. Do you agree with that sentiment?
Well, yeah, I do think that I've seen fewer really good movies in the last 20 years. But also, I haven't updated my list since the pandemic started, I think. I've got the list. I just need to put it on the website. So you caught me.
All right. Well, that's good, though. We love movies, and they're a great way to escape. And, I watched a couple of movies recently that were interesting, but I wouldn't recommend. There was one on Netflix I watched. I was like, yeah, it was not a waste of my 2 hours, but I definitely wouldn't tell my friends to watch it either. It had DiCaprio in it, but anyway. All right, let's talk policy a little bit. Now, I'm going to give you my situation, and maybe you can address this a little bit. My wife has reached, she works for the government. She has reached a 30-year plateau and could retire at any time. I'm getting up there, and I'm a little bit older than you, I think, but I'm getting up there too. So retirement is theoretically not very far away for the two of us, but healthcare, oh man, being able to pay for healthcare, we're just in a quandary here. We're like, how long are we going to have to work? Because once you retire, you know, you're kind of on your own for healthcare. Give me kind of in a nutshell your thoughts on the healthcare system in America. And I know that's a big ask, but just kind of give me a brief summary.
Sure. Briefly, American healthcare is, you know, it's the best of times and the worst of times. We have a system that is really quite good in a lot of ways. I mean, best cancer survival rates, shortest wait times to see a doctor on average, mm-hmm. and so on. But we also have some problems. Our life expectancies have been dropping in the last few years, and obesity and childhood nutrition problems have been going up.
Yeah.
The cost of health care, of course, has doubled since the enactment of the so-called Affordable Care Act, which, by the way, the 14th anniversary was 2 days ago, and we now know that Obamacare has made health care less affordable. It's harder to find a doctor. And so what about the person who wants to retire? There is a Medicare program. It's actually skinny coverage. It's not as good as what you might have gotten from an employer during your working years. But for a lot of people, it's an important safety net, and it's politically very popular. And, you know, you're eligible at age 65 for Medicare, but a lot of people end up having to buy additional health insurance to fill in the gaps.
Yeah, and that's where I'm at. I'm about probably five or six years away from actually qualifying for Medicare, and so I can't really retire, right, because I'm stuck. Because, as you said, the Affordable Care Act is actually ironically named now because it's not.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And retirement itself is kind of becoming a bit of a dream anymore, people having to work longer to make ends meet despite Social Security and Medicare because of, you know, Bidenomics, Bidenflation. I mean, the cost of living keeps going up, and when people retire, they often have basically a fixed income, and inflation just hits them very hard.
Yeah.
And in my own case, I'm not planning to claim Social Security till I'm 70, basically because your benefit keeps growing until 70, but it stops growing as soon as you claim it. So I could claim it at, early as 62, but I'm going to wait till 70. But will I try to keep earning, you know, sort of a full-time paycheck until then? Well, maybe not. I'll ease back. But for a lot of Americans, sadly, they don't have an option to ease back. And so we do need to fix a lot of things so that we can actually have a good retirement in this country.
Well, that was kind of my next question. Are these things fixable? Is there something we can do as a consumer or even as our government that can make this whole healthcare gap and problem better than it is?
Yes, absolutely. And at Americans for Prosperity, we have a plan to do it, a doctor-supported plan we call the Personal Option. It's a series of basically common-sense incremental reforms to our health system that would make health care less expensive. Uh-huh. It would make it easier for you to find a doctor, to tailor your benefits, to have more control of your medical decisions. You know, very different from Obamacare. And what are the key provisions of that? It would be things like making sure everybody can have their federal subsidy for health care, because most Americans do get some kind of subsidy, whether they realize it or not, for health insurance. Let them choose where they can use that and what kind of insurance they buy with it, and then let them save whatever they don't spend on insurance in a tax-free health savings account where you can use that for copays, deductibles, devices, drugs at the pharmacy, really anything medical. And by the way, also you can use it for doctors that are not in your health insurance plan's network. That's an increasing problem. It's getting harder to see a doctor because of Obamacare. And with if everyone had an HSA account, they would have a lot more choice and control and more money for health care. And then the last thing, let everybody buy doctor's services by subscription, you know, like a Netflix subscription.
Mm-hmm.
This is a growing movement. It's called direct primary care. You cut out the insurance company middleman, and you just pay the doctors a monthly fee, and then you've got all kinds of access. They spend more time with you. They're more responsive. They give you telehealth standard. It's really a better model for how to deliver, you know, anything except really expensive or emergency health services. So that's the personal option. And we are working in Congress and in the states to enact these reforms so that every American can get the health care they need when they need it at a price they can afford with the quality they deserve from the medical professionals they trust.
Well, you're sure right about the way they're dropping. We have public employee health PHP, and we've had two or three doctors and dentists drop us, say, we don't take that anymore. I guess because they didn't like the way PHP negotiated or whatever. But yeah, that's a frustrating thing. And then, we have a doctor here on the station that advertises what he calls concierge doctor services, where, like you said, he actually spends time with the patient. Most of the times you go to see your primary care physician, you're in there for 15, 20 minutes, you might see the doctor, you might see a PA or just a nurse or whatever. It's boom, boom, get you in and out and collect your, you know, $150 or whatever it is.
Right. No, that's exactly right. Concierge medicine, excuse me, is exactly the same thing as direct primary care, except, you know, sometimes concierge doctors will also take insurance. But DPC doctors typically do not take insurance. They're just direct pay only. And patients and doctors love it.
Now, we've only got about 10 minutes, so it's a short amount of time to get into your American Renewal Plan. But I thought maybe we could spend just a couple of minutes talking about some of your ideas. We mentioned you're an optimist. We mentioned you're a guy who believes every American should have the right to, well, be happy, pursue happiness. Let's talk a little bit about your American Renewal Plan and some of your ideas there.
Sure, and I want to make sure listeners understand that this plan is just my own ideas. We have to take off my Americans for Prosperity hat when discussing this because they don't necessarily agree with everything I've written. As you know, on my website, the plan is kind of long and detailed. It's got a whole bunch of different ideas for trying to make America America again.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, key elements of that are first of all, ballot integrity. Let's make sure that we can trust the results of elections so we know what the people actually want. Let's follow the Constitution scrupulously, and when it would cause disruption, let's amend the Constitution if necessary or find a transition so we can get back to being right with the Constitution. I would eliminate all forms of income tax. I would go back to funding the government with tariffs and excises. I'm pretty sure AFP does not agree with me on that one. They tend to hate tariffs.
Yeah.
I would make sure that the budget is balanced. I have a proposed amendment in there, and I would go back to gold, you know, backing the dollar so it's not a fiat currency, and so that basically we can kill inflation, and that way the middle class and the poor can rise based on their hard work and savings rather than having it basically stolen from them by politicians who are creating inflation intentionally.
Yeah.
So those are a few highlights of my plan.
One of your planks for this American Renewal Plan is something called Restore Consent-Based Citizenship. Will you explain what that means?
Yeah, that's basic. You could think of that as immigration reform, but it's more than that. It's the idea that in America, citizenship is by consent of both the individual and the government. That's different from the old, call it monarchical system, where if you're born on the soil of the king, you are the king's subject, whether you like it or not. And if you try to transfer your allegiance to, say, some other king or country, that's treason. And when the American Revolution happened, we effectively got rid of that old non-consensual basis for citizenship and replaced it with a consent-based system. And that the reason it's an issue is because our courts and a lot of politicians believe that our Constitution requires birthright citizenship, which is basically a form of that old, you know, idea. It's the soil. Whatever soil you're born on determines your citizenship. And that's not an accurate reading of the Constitution. The 14th Amendment does say that anyone born on our soil is a U.S. citizen, but they have to have political allegiance to the United States. And that, people tend to read that qualifier out of the text. And the result is we have these birth tourists coming just to have a baby on U.S. soil.
Yeah.
We've got, of course, lots of unlawful entrants coming in through the southern border, and they're having children, and those children are becoming citizens automatically. And I think we need to go back to what the Constitution and the founders intended. That would solve a lot of problems. And I also do think we need to build physical barriers on the border to get this in-migration under control.
Well said. You won't get any argument from me on that. Let's talk about one of your planks is devolve unconstitutional spending. Now, the federal government has become just a monster. I mean, there are literally more than 2,000, maybe close to 3,000 federal departments, agencies, programs, et cetera. And people that work in those departments will tell you, well, we are absolutely crucial. The feds have got to have this program in place. And yet every one of those agencies takes money to, you know, pay people that work there, money for you know, their programs and money to, this is, you know, almost bribe people to get involved. How can we devolve? How can we get rid of some of that? It seems like the federal government doesn't have a conscience. They don't have a budget. They have one, but they don't follow it. How can we do something about that?
Well, you're right. Since the New Deal, basically, we've lived under an unlimited federal government, even though the Constitution requires that it be limited in various ways. And so we're kind of, just in uncharted waters. And as a result, we have this proliferation of spending programs and entitlements and activities that are not constitutional. Devolution is the term I use. It means you take a program that's not constitutional or is just not a good idea, and you give it back to the states. But the way you do that is you eliminate it at the federal level, and you cut federal taxes by an amount sufficient so that if the state wants to continue that program, they have the resources available to do it. That's devolution, and the feds should do that with respect to, I think, hundreds of programs, many agencies and so on, activities that they're doing now that they shouldn't be. Devolution.
Talking with Dean Clancy today. Dean, I am hardly a land expert, but I know this. A lot of land in the state of Utah, where I live, is owned by the federal government. One of your planks is to sell the unneeded federal land. What do you mean by that, and is that realistic?
Well, it might require a constitutional amendment to make it happen. I mean, historically, and Utah is one of the victims of this, basically most land, federal land, was sold in the 19th century until you get to the Mississippi River. And then as the country expanded across, a lot of that land became federal and was never sold or given to the states. And as a result, states like Utah, most of the land in the state is owned by the federal government or controlled by it. And that's just not right, in my opinion. And I think a lot of folks out west would agree. So what I propose is that you basically give the land to the states, lease it to them, for a period of 99 years. So it would technically still be federal. But then in that 99-year period, you would pass a constitutional amendment basically saying the federal government may not own more than 10% of the surface area of the United States, nor 10% of any individual state. And therefore, at the end of the term, if it still had too much land in its portfolio, it would have to give that to the states. And then I try to deal with the problem of, like, national parks, Yellowstone and Grand Canyon, Bryce, and all these wonderful treasures. Some people are afraid that if you give it to the states, they'll just build condominiums on it or something, which I think is not right. But they wouldn't do that. But just to ensure they would do that, during that transition, you would require the states to protect that land, and then hopefully after that everything would be fine. You need a transition here, but the situation we've got now, I think, is just completely unsupportable.
There's a famous movie clip about a guy, a student asks a guy on a panel why America is the greatest country in the world, and he proceeds to kind of badmouth America and cite all the reasons why America, the United States, is not the greatest country in the world. I know that that rubs the wrong way to me. I think it rubs the wrong way to you. America is the greatest country. We should have pride in America. And, you know, Dean, as we talk about this stuff, how can we reestablish some of that pride for, well, being an American?
Well, my view is that the reason we're unhappy as a people in so many ways is because we have stopped following the Constitution. And the beauty of the Constitution is that it, you know, it protects property rights, it protects our ability to pursue happiness, and it limits government, which protects our liberty. And the result is we all feel a certain love and even fraternity, brotherhood, coming out of our way of life. And that is being lost because we've gotten away from those rules. It's quite possible for us to be a happy, prosperous, just, and, of course, continually powerful nation if we follow the rules.
That's key, and that's well said. Dean, I got to let you go. Got another interview coming up, but thank you for spending a few minutes with us today. If you want to learn more, folks, go to deanclancy.com. I love your website. Very informative and very fun to read. Dean, thanks for your time today. Appreciate it.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
KDXU News Time is 9:29. We're going to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, we've got Emily Merkley to join us. Emily is with the Washington County Board of Realtors, and she's going to explain this lawsuit that just about commissions and realtors and all that stuff. That's when we come back.
All the latest news, weather, traffic, and sports, just like you like them. You're waking up with the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
Thanks again to Dean Clancy for being on the program. Right now we have Emily Merkley on the phone line. Hi, Emily. How are you?
I'm good, Andy. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for coming on. That lawsuit was finally settled and taken care of, and now I have all kinds of questions, and I know you have all kinds of answers. Emily, of course, is with the Washington County Board of Realtors. Emily, lawsuit, what's going on there? Can you explain maybe the nuts and bolts of this lawsuit involving realtors and commissions?
I sure can, and thanks for having me on again. Yes, I think there's a lot of different headlines going on in the national media, many of which are clickbait headlines. Commissions can and will continue to be paid. You see, realtors are still legally able to represent home buyers and sellers, and that's determined by the individual state laws. The settlement does not change that. Realtors are still able to charge commissions for the services that they provide now and beyond the July settlement implementation date. What we're happy about is this litigation has gone on for years. And while the realtor organization admits no fault in commission setting a standard, this really does give us a path forward, right? We can adapt, we can adjust, and still work to serve the consumer in our local communities.
So let's talk from the realtor perspective, first of all. If I'm a realtor, is it encouraged, is it discouraged to say, hey, I can sell your house, but I can do it for 1.5% or is that even going to come up, or is it just assumed it's still going to be 3% or 2%? I don't know. What do you think?
No, and multiple commission structures have existed in Utah and even here in Washington County for decades. You know, some agents charge 6%, others 4%. Some we've seen even 7 and 8%. And in other cases, even just a flat fee. What's becoming more clear to consumers as a result of this settlement is the idea that commissions are negotiable. So truly, clients have been able to have these conversations with their agent for some time. What services are you providing? What are you charging for that service, and is it negotiable? And the answer is yes.
So if we look at it from the consumer perspective, like you were just talking about, I go to sell my house, okay, and I find a realtor that I think is going to do a good job for me. Where does it come into play on what the commission is? I mean, is that before I sign? Should I talk to them about that? Is it going to be, you know, is it going to be right out front in a contract that I sign with them? How does that all work?
So the contracts have already been transparent and clear for decades in Utah. Mm-hmm. You have two different agreements. You have an agreement with the seller and the listing agent. They enter into an agreement to price, advertise, facilitate a sell, and that contract specifies the total amount of commission being paid to the listing agent, but it also discloses that agent's intent to share that commission with a cooperating buyer's agent.
Okay.
So not much is changing in terms of the contract that the buyers and the sellers entered into. But we do need to remember that one type of commission structure has stood the test of time, you know, through 18% mortgage rates, economic fluctuations, and even a recession. And it's what we're most familiar with is commission sharing. Just like I said, seller contracts with a listing agent. They determine a price or a percentage, and the seller agrees to allow that listing agent to sell in order to open up and widen the pool of buyers that home can attract. This model allows buyers to be represented without paying more money out of pocket, and which essentially gives buyers more spending power. And so the idea of commission sharing, again, has stood the test of time, and it is still permitted going forward. It's permitted by the state with the state laws that govern agents and their real estate transactions, and it's still permitted within this settlement. With that said, what I think is becoming more clear is that buyers and sellers have more options than maybe what they thought they did. So as a seller, the seller can pay their listing agent and their listing agent only. They can say, I'm paying you. I don't want to pay a cooperating broker. Let's put that on the buyer, right? They can also pay their listing agent and still allow them to offer a cooperating compensation to the agent, or they could essentially do a combination of both. Say, I'll pay maybe a minimum flat fee to the buyer and pay you a percentage. At the end of the day, it's a conversation that the seller will need to have with the agent, and the agent will have to be able to articulate, these are the services I provide for the fee that I'm charging for these services that I'm getting.
Do you feel it will be advantageous for realtors or for consumers to try to negotiate that? If I go to a realtor and I'm going to sign on with him and I say, you know, I don't really like that number you put on that piece of paper, let's talk about that. Is that something that's going to happen, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And I think savvy consumers have been doing that already. You know, agents can lay out all of the services they provide, and one seller may say, you know what? I don't need professional photos. I'm an amateur photographer. Let me take the photos. So can we remove that from your services and maybe scale back on the fee that you're charging, right?
Yeah.
There's minimum standards that agents have to offer as a condition of their license. But in terms of sometimes writing contracts or some of the negotiations, the seller can say, I want to do that on my own. And so let's maybe identify a flat fee for advertising my property and putting it on the MLS. Or they can say, I want everything. I want all the services you have. What is the fee that you charge or percentage that you charge for those services? And then agree to that. So absolutely, if anything, I think consumers are just becoming more aware that they have options when it comes to compensating their agent.
I like that. Options are always good, right, Emily?
They are, absolutely. And buyers have those options, too.
Now, I know you work for, you know, your Washington County Board of Realtors, and so the realtors are certainly your concern. But as just a regular consumer, I remember last time we bought a house, my wife and I couldn't even imagine not having a realtor involved in all the paperwork and all the stuff that goes into it. I know that there are people out there, they do like the FSBO, you know, for sale by owner and stuff. But tell me why that, if you think that's a bad idea, if you think that's a difficult thing, or if you think it's a good idea.
I mean, ultimately, that is up to the person selling their home. However, with that said, there's a lot of risk, there's a lot of liability, and potentially money left on the table when consumers go about this alone. I think as the internet emerged, it was predicted that many service professionals would diminish. And we've seen this with travel agents, taxi drivers, stock traders. But the importance of having an actual human real estate professional, a realtor, has actually grown. And suggesting otherwise, you know, would be like saying attorneys are obsolete because of LegalZoom and doctors because of WebMD, right?
Yeah.
But studies show that 9 in 10 home sellers will still choose to hire an agent when selling a home, that they're looking to reduce risk. Because of the increasingly complex and litigious real estate landscape. So buyers and sellers are turning to the expertise of an agent. And studies also show that homes sell for far more when represented by an agent as opposed to for sell by owner. And oftentimes, too, buyers and sellers who opted out of using representation often report dissatisfaction with the process, which usually stems from either legal mistakes were made, the paperwork was challenging, or it resulted in financial losses. So a realtor's involvement is still essential, and it's financially beneficial to the consumer.
Well, people can make fun of me and say, hey, you're drinking the Kool-Aid, but I wholeheartedly believe you. I would not want to try to navigate, negotiate without a realtor representing me and quite frankly, representing the person I would buy from as well. I just, to me, there's just so many things that you could forget or that could go wrong or that could be left out if you didn't have the protection of somebody on your side.
No, right, and it works to the benefit of buyers too. Long ago, there was still kind of a commission sharing structure, but it was more of a finder's fee. So the buyer still had no representation, but if an agent found them a home, that buyer's agent was paid a finder's fee. But they realized soon that buyers need representation just as much as the sellers, to ensure that the buyer's best interest is also being addressed, right? And so that's where it went from a finder's fee to a cooperative compensation. I'm a listing agent. I have a listing. I'm offering a cooperative compensation. I just opened the pool of buyers that can be exposed to my seller's listing, which benefits my seller, but like I said, it also benefits the buyer in a way that they also have representation and they're not cost burdened by the additional expense of representation.
Yeah, well said. All right. Emily, I got to take a commercial break here. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the market. I think people will be surprised to know 262 homes sold in Washington County last month. That's a pretty big number. We'll talk about that and more, median house prices and all that's going on with the market. Real quick, Emily, before I go to commercial, bottom line, this lawsuit one more time, just real quick, what does it mean to the everyday person?
It means you have options.
I love it. Options. All right. Thank you, Emily. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's News Talk Leader.
Welcome back, 950 on KDXU. Emily Merkley from the Washington County Board of Realtors is on the line with me today. Hi, Emily. Thanks for coming on.
You bet.
Appreciate you being here. If you had to describe the I don't know, the atmosphere of realty in the in Washington County right now? Are there a few words? I'm not going to limit you to one word, but maybe one phrase or one thought on what real estate is like in Washington County right now. What would they be?
What, Washington, like real estate in general, or as a result of the settlement?
No. Let's leave the settlement out of it for now. Just kind of real estate in general.
Real estate in general, we're seeing the normal pickup that we see every spring.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
More interest, more buyers entering the market, more options available to buyers entering the market. So typical spring in southern Utah.
Now, I've heard some people say, well, we sure have a lot of cash buyers coming from either California or Nevada or from northern Utah. Are there more cash buyers now than there used to be?
No, that seems to be trending the same. What's interesting about cash buyers is economic conditions aren't an issue, right? They're not worried about mortgage interest rates.
Right.
And so they tend to be present in the market, especially resort type markets like ours, all the time. So I wouldn't say we're seeing more, but we're not seeing any less. And interesting fact, we do have a lot of buyers coming from California. We have buyers coming from Colorado, Washington, D.C., Virginia, and New York. Those are hot spots
really, of
buyers looking at our local MLS.
Well, we know what attracts them here. This is an incredible place to be. I don't know that we necessarily want some of them coming here. I'm not going to say, I already said it, but I'm going to retract that. They're welcome. We love them as long as they don't try to change too much here when they get here. But Emily, there were 262 houses sold in the month of February. That's right in line with what we've had for the last 6 months. In fact, a little bit more than, say, October and December. Does that mean that the real estate market right now is really healthy?
I would say it is healthy. I think that the interest rates are still high, which is holding some buyers back. They're waiting for them to dip a little bit lower, hoping to get closer to low 6% or even below 6%. So there still is pent-up demand, but we're starting to see a little bit more confidence in the market. People are making the decision to purchase. It's favoring sellers and buyers a little bit more, so a little bit more balanced than what we saw during those COVID years when it favored the sellers heavily.
Now, the saying is out there now that St. George is becoming a tourist town, is becoming a resort town. Is Washington County a resort county now?
We have elements of a resort county, yes. We've got hotels, new hotels popping up. We've got designated short-term rental communities. We have short-term and nightly rentals are in huge demand. So, yes, that would indicate that there is a resort-type element to our real estate market.
Now, VRBO and Airbnb they've taken a couple of pretty big hits lately. Stuff about cameras in rooms and new rules and really bad experiences by a lot of people that have a short-term rental. Do those two big companies who make billions of dollars, do those two big companies taking hits have an effect on the real estate market right here in Washington County?
That is a good question, and honestly, I don't know the answer to that. We're still seeing an interest in people wanting to purchase short-term and nightly rentals. So the interest in having that type of property as an investment is still there. So that would suggest that maybe it's not deterring too many from people still purchasing a nightly rental.
The median home price, sold price in the last month in February was $480,000. Like me, you probably have some young kids kids that are maybe looking to get, that are getting married, want to buy a house, and it just doesn't seem realistic, even with all the incentives and the programs and stuff for them to buy a house. I mean, a 22-year-old kid probably not going to be able to afford a $400,000 house or a $480,000 house. Do you have any other ideas for young people, Emily, who want to get into it? Because we know owning a home is really going to make you a more prosperous person all around.
Oh, no. Studies show that home buyers or home owners in general build wealth at a faster rate than opposed to somebody who doesn't own a home. So ultimately, that is the goal. I mean, you have a rent payment now, 100% goes to the landlord and nothing is being made in terms of equity, right? So ultimately, we want the ability for every buyer who desires to own a home to reach that goal. I would say get in touch with an agent, be prepared. See, that's the thing that most don't realize is they wait until they're ready to buy a home to get in touch with an agent.
Yeah.
But an agent can help provide a path, right, and give some guidelines on how to reach that goal sooner. Maybe there's options available now that they didn't know existed, so that when the time is right for that buyer, they're ready to take that step and they're ready to make an offer on a home. And yes, and there are options. There are down payment programs available to first-time home buyers in the state of Utah that are really, really helping. So yeah, I would say get in touch with an agent sooner rather than later.
Yeah, good advice there. You mentioned, back to the lawsuit, you mentioned that the process is maybe going to change a little bit, especially for buyers. We've got about 2 minutes left. How has the process changed for, will the process change for buyers now?
So what buyers are going to find out really quickly is the process has changed a little bit. A buyer will need to enter into a contractual agreement with an agent at the start of the process. They've been used to doing that later on. But again, they have options in terms of compensating their representation. We've obviously established sellers can still offer cooperating compensation. That has not gone away. Buyers can ask sellers directly to pay for their agent's costs in the absence of a cooperating commission offering. They can ask as they would, you know, closing costs or a rate buy down. That the buyer can pay their agent directly if they have the funds available, or they can do a combination of all the options stated. But one significant rule that came or is coming as a result of this settlement is cooperating compensation can no longer be offered or facilitated through the multiple listing service. So where it was once displayed on our multiple listing service and buyers could actually see what their agents were being compensated on sites like our MLS, SouthernUtahRealEstate.com, that has been removed. The MLS is removing themselves. It has to be conducted between the buyer and the seller, or the buyer's agent and the seller's agent. That's one significant change that I think is going to be a little bit harder for buyers to understand what is being offered, if a commission is offered, and how much is it.
She's Emily Merkley, Washington County Board of Realtors. Where can we learn more about your organization and about all the stuff we've been talking about, Emily?
So two websites, SouthernUtahRealEstate.com is our local MLS system. There's plenty of information and resources as well as property searches there. And if you're curious to learn more about what realtors do, you can head to our board website, which is WashingtonCountyRealtors.com.
Awesome. Thank you, Emily. Great to talk to you today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.